Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. This week, we're featuring a four-part series from the 2024 Summer Institute at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor. Today, we end our series with a conversation with legal scholar Jeffrey Rosen and political scientist Judith Goldstein. The title of today's talk is Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness. Jeffrey Rosen is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and a professor of law at George Washington University Law School. His most recent book is The Pursuit of Happiness: How Classical Writers on Virtue Inspired the Lives of the Founders and Defined America. Judith Goldstein is the founder of Humanity in Action and a professor of international communication at Stanford University. This program was recorded live on August 2, 2024. It will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org.
So happiness, I must say, the title of what is so important to you, Jeff, I think happiness is having you back. That's really quite wonderful. And this time we have them for a twofer, last night and this morning. So welcome again. And I think happiness is also a word that describes for this audience and beyond the changes in the political landscape in the past, almost the past 2 weeks. So having tasted depression and gloom, many of us now feel elation, I think, and hope and happiness. And happiness also from the conversations that we've been having over the past 5 days at this outstanding summit. A major contention in the book is that among classical and Enlightenment thinkers, the founders and great leaders such as Douglas and Lincoln, private happiness and self-control were deemed as essential to social happiness and the constructive discourse in promoting the well-being of the democracy. When did you recognize and decide that this linkage is deeply important to democracy today?
Well, first of all, happiness is being back on Mount Desert Island.
Hey!
I'm so grateful to you, Judy, for the historic coffee with Will that led to the creation of this magnificent institute. It's so meaningful to be back. I'm so glad that it's continuing. And I'm so glad that after we solved all the problems of democracy 7 years ago, there's nothing for us to sort out anymore today. Let me share with you the story of how I came to this amazing topic about how classical writers on virtue inspired the lives of the founders and defined America, and how it changed my ideas about how to be a good person and how to be a good citizen. It was during COVID that a series of unexpected synchronicities led me to realize that for both Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, the pursuit of happiness meant not feeling good, but being good, not the pursuit of immediate pleasure, but the pursuit of long-term virtue. And here is how I realized this crucial insight. I was rereading the part of Ben Franklin's autobiography where he describes his effort in his 20s to achieve moral perfection. And Franklin made a list of 12 virtues that he later expanded to 13. Prudence, order, temperance, cleanliness. He saved the one he found hardest for last, humility. And he put the 13 virtues on the x-axis and the days of the week on the y, and each night he resolved to put an X mark next to the virtue where he fell short. He tried this for a while. He found it was incredibly depressing because there were so many X marks, but he was better for having tried to improve himself. I knew about this project because a rabbi in Washington, D.C. about 10 years ago recommended that a friend and I try the Hebrew version of Franklin's 13 virtues. It's called the Musar system, a system of character improvement for Jews. Basically, a Hasidic rabbi in the 18th century admired Franklin and translated the virtues into Hebrew. So not knowing that they came from Franklin, we tried this for a while. We found it's incredibly depressing. And we also gave it up, but we thought we were better for having tried. What I saw during COVID was what Franklin chose as the motto for his project was a book by Cicero that I'd never heard of called the Tusculan Disputations, and the motto was, "Without virtue, happiness cannot be." A few weeks later, I was at the Boar's Head Inn in Charlottesville, Virginia, on the UVA campus, and in the hotel room was a list of 12 virtues that Jefferson had drafted for his daughters. I'd never seen this list before. It looked quite similar to Franklin's list, although Jefferson left one of the Franklin virtues off of his list, and that was chastity. And otherwise, Jefferson also had the same mottos like Franklin: silence, when angry, count to 10, when very angry, 100. Resolution, resolve to do what you ought and do what you resolve. But what really struck me is that when Jefferson was asked to explain his list of virtues, he would send a passage from Cicero's Tusculan Disputations. And in fact, it was to a schoolmaster in Maine who wrote to him about the meaning of happiness that he first sent this passage. He would then send it to anyone who asked him when he was old the meaning of happiness. And it says from Cicero, "He who has achieved tranquility of soul, who is neither unduly exuberant or unusually despondent, he is the wise man of whom we are in quest. He is the happy man." So I thought, obviously, I've got to read the Cicero book because it was so important to Franklin and Jefferson for defining happiness as virtue. But what else to read? And then I found this golden reading list that Jefferson would send to anyone who wrote to him when he was old and asked him how to be educated. And he would send this to kids who are going to law school, who are the kids of his parents and his friends, and to his friends. And it's a remarkable list. You've got to check it out. It includes sections on literature and political philosophy and history and law. And what's so significant is that Jefferson prescribes not only the books to be read, but the time of day to read them. And he says, you've got to wake up before dawn and spend 2 hours reading moral philosophy and watch the sunrise. And then in the late morning, you can read political philosophy and history, then lunch, science and astronomy, then dinner, Shakespeare and a little poetry is allowed, and then to bed, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, no breaks. Okay, so it's COVID and we had more time and something came over me, so I decided to follow Jefferson's schedule. And in particular, to read the section that he called moral philosophy or ethics or natural religion. And at the top of that list was Cicero, the Tusculan Disputations, and then Seneca's letters, Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, and Enlightenment philosophers like Locke, Hutcheson, Hume, and Bolingbroke. I felt that I needed to read these books because it was a gap in my education. I've had this marvelous liberal arts education, and I'm grateful each day for the incredible teachers who inspired me at these wonderful universities to study political philosophy, history, literature, and law. But despite all that, I'd missed these books of moral philosophy because they'd fallen out of the curriculum by the time I was in college in the 80s. And I remember yearning for this kind of guidance in college. Will and I were in the same class. It was the 80s. It was the kind of greed is good decade, and I was unsatisfied by the hedonism and materialism that were celebrated by pop culture. I was also unsatisfied by the Puritan theology that I was studying as an English major. And Puritan theology was not doing it for me as a guide about how to live. It's very arduous. No amount of good works or even faith will redeem you unless you're the recipient of God's randomly given grace. Plus, I'm Jewish. So I was looking for a guide about how to live a good life. And what I didn't realize, because this classical moral philosophy fell out of the curriculum, was that this is exactly the question that the classical philosopher set out to answer. So it's COVID. I still can't believe I did it. I got up every morning before sunrise. I read the philosophy for 2 hours. I watched the sunrise, and then I found myself writing sonnets to sum up the wisdom that I'd learned. And I know that this seems incredibly weird. But then it turned out that all sorts of people in the founding era wrote sonnets to sum up these poems of virtue, including Alexander Hamilton, who wrote sonnets, the great Phyllis Wheatley, the first published black poet who wrote these brilliant poems of virtue that George Washington acclaimed, Mercy Otis Warren, and then John Quincy Adams would wake up in the White House, read Cicero in the original, especially the Tusculan Disputations, write these beautiful sonnets of freedom, and he valued these even more than his political achievements. So that's the way it happened. It was a deeply meaningful year. And the biggest takeaway, and I just want to share it up front, in addition to transforming my understanding of how to be a good person and how to be a good citizen, to changing my understanding of the founders and how they conceived how to lead a good life and the relationship between democracy and personal and political self-government, Mostly, it just got me back in the habit of deep reading because I've fallen out of the habit, which I had in college, of reading for stuff outside of immediate deadlines or classes. I found myself as addicted to these devices that we all carry as everyone else, and lots of browsing and excuses, but just not reading books. So the takeaway from the project, which I want to share with you, is I am not always catching the sunrise, although I did, I missed it by about a half hour, but I went to Schooner Head this morning, which is an amazing place to see the end of the sunrise. And the rule is until I've done my reading, I'm not allowed to browse or check email or do anything else. And it's a transformative habit. I'm back in the habit of reading. I'm writing a new book, and just the radically transformative power of deep reading is something that I've become an evangelist for, and I urge it on all of you.
So to go from that optimism, we're all revved up to do this, a bit of pessimism, because I've heard you say in a somewhat resigned way that the American democratic experiment over more than 200 years may be running its course. Can you, this distinguished legal scholar, prolific author, journalist and leader of the National Constitution Center, assess the vitality and value based on the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the value of our current democratic experience?
Let me answer that by talking about what I learned about how the founders thought about the future of democracy and how they applied these lessons in their lives. And just give you a couple of examples of the fact that none of them was sure that the experiment would succeed. And at the end of their lives, they don't know whether the people will find enough virtue to keep the republic. And by virtue, they meant the self-mastery, self-improvement, character improvement, being your best self, overcoming your ego-based passions or emotions so you can be guided by the reason that alone can reveal truth. It's this antithesis between reason and passion that I came to realize is the heart of classical moral philosophy. Essentially, it's a version of the marshmallow test. Remember at Stanford in the 70s, kids who wanted one marshmallow would get it if they took it immediately, but if they could wait 15 minutes, they got two marshmallows. And the kids who could wait did much better later in life. And the essence of all of the moral philosophy, whether from the classical or Christian or Jewish or Eastern Buddhist or Hindu sources, all of which the founders saw the similarities between, is the need for that sober second thought, impulse control, so we can overcome our unproductive emotions like anger, jealousy, and fear, and achieve the long-term well-being that defines happiness. Here are some examples of how the different founders didn't achieve it and what they thought about democracy. I start with Abigail and John Adams. John reads Cicero in college, and when his parents have fights, he'll take up Cicero to calm himself down. When he and Abigail meet, they decide, in the spirit of Pythagoras, who inspired Greek moral philosophy, to make a list of each other's faults, which is not a good idea generally as a dating strategy. And it almost went off the rails because Abigail, who's very generous, said, "Well, people say your fault is that you're haughty or vain, but in fact, it's just that you're so brilliant that you're intellectually intimidating and people are, afraid of you." And John responds, "Well, you should practice the piano more and read more, plus your pigeon tone." And she responds in great good humor, "I'll try to read more and practice the piano more, but a gentleman should never comment on a lady's posture." They have this beautiful intellectual, moral, and romantic friendship based on overcoming your passions. Abigail loves to cite the Jewish proverb, "He who is slow to anger is greater than he who's conquered a village." And she's always enjoining John Quincy to achieve that self-mastery. John, who is indeed famously vain and self-regarding, which is why I have him in the humility chapter, falls out with his friends, Mercyotis Warren and Thomas Jefferson, but crucially, he makes up with them. Mercyotis Warren, the great anti-federalist, poetic genius, John commissions her to write these poems of virtue. about the revolution. She is acclaimed, and then they fall out over politics because she writes an anti-federalist history of the US. She's a Jeffersonian. She accuses Adams of being vain and a monarchist. He loses it. How dare you accuse Adams of being a monarchist? He talks in the third person about himself. Adams isn't a monarchist. She said, well, you know, you praise the British Constitution. They don't talk for a while. They make up because Abigail sends her a lock of her hair. And then John champions Mercy. And she says, just one favor, some guy's taken credit for writing my satire of the revolution in the Boston Athenaeum. Can you say that I wrote it? John gets on a horse, rides to Boston, and writes on the title page, this was written by Mercy Ernest Warren. So he has the capacity for self-awareness and forgiveness. And that's also key to his reconciliation with Jefferson. And among the most moving moments in American letters is Jefferson and Adams' correspondence as old men. And what do they want to talk about? The connections between the Eastern and Western wisdom traditions. And Adams is so excited when he learns that Pythagoras may have traveled to the East and read the Hindu Vedas. And he says, when this is proved, it'll show that all the traditions of the world can be summed up in the hymn of Cleanth, love God of all his creatures, rejoice in all things. And Adams notes the similarity between the injunction of the Gita, renounce and enjoy, as Gandhi would quote it, renounce attachment to eternal events and enjoy eternal salvation, and that of the Stoic dichotomy of control. Abandon expectations and attempts to control the thoughts and actions of others. Focus on the only thing you can control, which is your own thoughts and actions. This incredibly liberating philosophy that the Buddhists express as we are what we think. Life is shaped by the mind. And what's so inspiring is that Adams and Jefferson are learning and growing in their 80s, and they're just seeing these connections. Adam is concerned that Joseph Priestley, who's examining the connections between the Vedas and the Pythagoras, may not have lived to complete his translation. Jefferson says, good news, he lived, I'll send you the book. And Adams is so excited that he will show this connection between Pythagoras and the East. And that's really what for me vindicates the founders. They fell short on so many levels of their ideals, most notably slavery, which I'll talk about in a sec. But until the end, they're learning, growing, and they've maintained the industry, those youthful habits of reading that they got as kids. Jefferson and slavery becomes even worse on close examination than I thought. The degree of his hypocrisy is really striking. He never defended slavery as consistent with the Declaration, nor did any of the enslavers of the founding generation. There's this amazing quotation from Patrick Henry, where Henry has just quoted Addison's Cato, give me liberty or give me death. And then he says, is it not amazing that I myself, who own slaves, and believe that slavery violates the Bible and natural law, how could I be an enslaver? And then Henry says, he doesn't even try to justify it. He says, I will not justify it. I will not attempt to. It's simple avarice or greed. I can't do with the inconvenience of living without it. And indeed, that's what it was. They knew it was wrong, but they liked the lifestyle and didn't want to give it up. And in these moments of candor, they acknowledge that and put it in these classical terms of avarice, greed, as opposed to industry and frugality. And Jefferson also recognizes it's wrong. And yet he, even more than all the other founders, lives this Palladian fantasy at Monticello. He imagines it as a kind of version of the Greek symposium, but actually it's this Caligulan Roman villa, which is stuffed with furniture that he buys in Paris. He gets himself in debt, and he's surrounded by his own kids. The people who are waiting for him at Monticello are his children by Sally Hemings, Beverly, and Houston. She came back from Paris. She was 16 and he was 42 when they began their sexual relationship. She agrees to come back on the condition that he free their kids when he dies, which he does. He frees no other members of his enslaved population though. And parents have to be separated from kids to pay his debts. He'd always insisted that the earth is held in usufruct for the living and one generation can impose its debts on the other. But he just is so extravagant and and such a hypocrite that the whole thing has to be sold. So that's striking. And the other hypocrisy that's so unbelievable is the degree of his racism. And I mentioned Phyllis Wheatley, the first great Black poet. This is an incredible story. She comes over from Africa enslaved, as a teenager, she's given education in the classics, in Cicero and Seneca and Epictetus, from her master and mistress who let her sit in on the schoolroom with their kids. She starts writing these incredible poems of virtue. They're so brilliant that they're acclaimed by George Washington, who recognizes her genius, and Ben Franklin. The city of Boston decides to hold a trial to establish whether or not she wrote her own poems. It's presided over by John Hancock, the guy who signed the Declaration in big letters, and Increase Mather and Cotton Mather, and they all examine her on the degree of her classical knowledge. She passes with flying colors, and she becomes what Professor Henry Louis Gates calls the Oprah Winfrey of her day. She's an international celebrity. She goes to London. She meets the Duke and Duchess. She gets the key to the city. Everyone acclaims her, with one exception, Jefferson. And in the Notes on the State of Virginia in Book 15, he says that the poetry of Phyllis Whatley, as he calls it, misspelling her name, is beneath contempt because she's Black and Black people can't write good poetry. That's what he, and then he digs himself in further. He says, you know, in Rome, the slaves were white and Terence was a great poet, but she's Black and she's not. It's shocking. And no other enslaver of that generation showed that degree of racism, not Washington, not Madison and the others. So it's a unfortunate blot on the legacy of Jefferson that he so flamboyantly betrays his ideals, but it is significant that he doesn't attempt to defend slavery. Contrast Jefferson with Washington, who's so self-mastered. And the greatness of Washington is his ability to achieve that calm tranquility that he gets from the consolation of mild philosophy. As he says, quoting Addison's Cato, to the troops at Newburgh when they rebel. And in 1784, it looks like the troops are going to have a mutiny because they can't be paid. Congress won't raise taxes because of the Articles of Confederation are weak. The soldiers aren't paid, and it looks like they're going to rebel. Washington mounts this wooden platform called the Temple of Virtue. He reads from Addison's Cato, and then he takes out his glasses and struggles to put them on and says, "Forgive me, gentlemen, I've grown old in your service and now I'm almost blind." And the troops weep because they've never seen him confess weakness before. And it's in this moment of sort of calm self-mastery that he's never appeared greater, according to his military aide. And that's the key to his success. He's considered the greatest member of the founding generation, not because he's the most brilliant or the most politically adventurous, but because he's the most self-mastered. And the Constitution wouldn't have happened without him. The fact that he showed up and everyone knew he'd be president is what allowed a strong Constitution to take place. But at the end of his life, he doesn't know whether the experiment will work. He's especially concerned about faction. And a faction is, according to Madison, any group, either a majority or a minority, animated by passion rather than reason, devoted to self-interest rather than the public good. There's that reason-passion distinction. Madison thinks that just as we must achieve calm tranquility in the constitution of our mind, so we have to achieve the same balance in the constitution of the state. And he says, in all large assemblies of any character controlled, passion never fails to wrest the scepter from reason. Even if every Athenian had been Socrates, Athens would still have been a mob. So they're very concerned about direct democracy. The Constitution's called because of Shays' Rebellion in Western Massachusetts. The farmers are rebelling and mobbing the federal courthouses. They've seen the ancient republics of Greece and Rome fail to tyrants, to Caesar. They're so afraid of demagogues like Caesar on horseback, who's going to come and, in exchange for cheap luxuries, persuade the people to give up liberty and then allow them to surrender Republican institutions. And there's an amazing letter that I found from Jefferson, which, when he first gets a copy of the Constitution, he writes to Madison and says, "I've got two objections. First, there's no Bill of Rights. And second, the president is eligible for re-election." And Jefferson said, "I'm concerned that in the future, a president may," and this is almost a direct quote, "lose an election by a few votes, cry foul, enlist the states who voted for him to keep him in office, and install himself for life." That's what Jefferson says. Wow, indeed. And Jefferson's solution is a one-year term limit for the president, so he won't be tempted to be a dictator. Hamilton also is afraid of a Caesar on horseback, but his solution to the man who'll come in, flatter the people, and reap the whirlwind, as he puts it, is a life term for the president. Because he thinks if the president is an elected monarch, he won't be tempted to subvert democratic elections and will be able to tend to the public good. They're both centrally concerned about demagogues, and they don't know whether the experiment will succeed. And Jefferson, by the end of his life, is afraid properly of the Union ripping apart over slavery. Hamilton wants a stronger executive. Washington fears of virtue. Only Madison is moderately optimistic. Why? Because of a new technology, which is the broadside press, that will allow complicated arguments like the Federalist Papers to disseminate across the whole scope of America. And he imagines citizens in their coffee houses and taverns reading the Federalist Papers, discussing them among themselves, communicating with their representative, and slowly allowing reason to spread across the land. He's especially enthusiastic about a new class of journalists he calls the literati, that will, like a group of, I don't know, New Yorker writers who will slowly persuade people through by writing thoughtful arguments, and also encourage them to read the primary text, to be guided by reason rather than passion. And plus, he's hopeful that the large size of America will make it hard for mobs to mobilize, because by the time they do, they'll get tired and go home. Obviously, we're living in a world very different from the one Madison hoped for. And in many ways, to answer your important question, we're living in Madison's nightmare. The advantage of size that Madison thought would allow passionate mobs to slowly peter out is undermined by technology. The technology itself allows posts based on passion to travel further and faster than those based on reason. The enraged to engage business model encourages journalists, public figures, and all citizens to express their angriest and most unproductive passions rather than to be guided by reason. And as a result, American politics is more polarized than at any time since the Civil War. And the founders' fears of demagogues have never seen more prescient. And so many of the cooling mechanisms and speed bumps and roadblocks that the constitutional framers set up to slow down deliberation and allow reason slowly to prevail have been undermined both by constitutional changes over the past 200 years and also by technology. So for all these reasons, optimism or pessimism is a question of temperament as much as political prognosticating. But now I understand better than I did before doing this reading why the founders thought it was all up to us, to individual citizens. When they talked about citizens having virtue, they didn't mean the virtues of, of faith, hope, and charity. They meant those Franklin-like virtues of moderation, prudence, temperance, courage, justice. The idea that moderation is the central Madisonian virtue becomes obvious when you see that the Federalist Papers are a paean to public happiness. That's the word that Franklin, that Hamilton and Madison use. And far from being a sort of mushy kumbaya ideal, it's central to the future of the Republic, unless citizens take the time to listen to one another, as Justice Breyer was so movingly saying last night, to have their minds open to points of view that they may disagree with, to be open to the possibility of changing their minds, and to moderate their immediate impulses, their factionate anger, to try to be guided by reason and conciliation, then we're not going to keep the Republic. And we don't know what's going to happen, and we never have. From the beginning, the founders weren't sure. And the Republicans of ancient times had limited time periods. Madison comes to the Constitutional Convention with a trunk full of books that Jefferson sends from Paris about the failed democracies of Greece and Rome. And he just takes careful notes on the reasons that all the democracies and republics in the past failed. And it was all because citizens lost their virtue. They chose tyrants, or they didn't defend liberty when it was under threat, and they allowed the Republican structures to atrophy. So it's always been an experiment. And in the wisest words that President Trump has ever uttered, we'll see.
To hone in a bit on what you've just said, there's a precious little distance on the ground, as Madison thought we had, which would damp down the capacity for violence and for fractions. But today, we master communications on a second-by-second basis. And what I might add that we don't even know the identity of some of the human beings with whom we are communicating, or whether through AI, there are human beings actually in the conversation. What would you say they would say about this dehumanization, this depersonalization that's going on? How do we deal with that?
It's so true, Judy, that people say stuff online that they wouldn't say face to face. It's as if we don't really know each other. There's something emboldening about the technology that allows you to play to the crowd. You're not speaking to another individual and trying to persuade. You're posturing to win the approval or the likes or the retweets of the most inflamed base. And that's the definition of faction. It's what creates parties. And Madison is so clear in The Federalists about how it's differences of religion and politics that have always created faction, which is a form of extremism devoted to passion rather than reason, to self-interest rather than the public good. And of course, distinguishing between what's self-interest and what's the public good may be in the eye of the faction itself, but there's something about these new technologies which are so gloriously empowering and giving everyone a voice, that have allowed us to be our worst self and allowed the center to atrophy because there's no incentive if you're a journalist or a politician to play to the center, which is not a reliable constituency as opposed to playing to the base. Could the technology save us? I must share with you how incredibly exciting I found the fact that today, all the books in the world are online. When I was a kid, I went to the Thomas Jefferson Building in Washington, D.C. with my mom, Estelle Rosen, who loved this island so much and would be so happy that we're all here together on MDI. And she took me to the Jefferson Building, and I think it's just incredible. There are these legends about the importance of reading and how the university of the future is a book, and there are pictures of the gods and goddesses of literature. And I was so filled with wonder as a young kid at the thought that all the books in the world were in that beautiful building. And now they're all online and they're just on my phone. And this device, which is so distracting and so inflaming, and the tweets and the retweets, carries all the books that I read to write this book. And I was able to write that whole book and do that whole sunshine reading lying on my couch at home. And all I need is the self-discipline to read it, to swipe left to the Kindle and not right to the blogs. And Jefferson said when he was old, "I've given up newspapers for Tacitus, and I feel much better in the morning, just reading the Greek the Roman historians rather than newspapers." And I must feel, and I do feel, that if the technologies are our addictive enemy because we're amusing ourselves and inflaming ourselves to death, they also hold the possibility for our redemption because there's so much wisdom online. And it's just the habit of deep reading that's so important. I really have also want to stress that this is not just a habit or a radical form of self-liberation for the privileged. I'm so moved by the fact that Frederick Douglass, when he was enslaved, the moment that he felt most shackled was not the time when he was forced to work for his master as an enslaved person, but when the master forbade him from learning how to read. He was learning how to read, suddenly he has to stop the reading lessons, and he felt crushed that his master was trying to control his thoughts. So what does he do? He goes onto the streets of Baltimore and he buys reading lessons with bread. He pays the boys who are on the streets of Baltimore to teach him how to read. And then he finds this golden book, which he also buys with bread, called the Columbian Orator. And it's a collection of selections from the classical moral philosophy, from Cicero, from Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, selections from Ben Franklin, and this dialogue about slavery, where a slave is arguing with his master for his freedom. And by using his reason, he's able to persuade the master to free him. And Douglas says, I will become like that enslaved person and win freedom for my people. And that's what he does. Just based on this single book, I was at Yale recently, and David Blight, the great Douglas biographer, brought out a first edition of that Columbian Orator. It's just this little book that was the bestseller of its time, hundreds of thousands of copies sold. It also inspired Lincoln, who read it in a log cabin. And you think what Douglas and Lincoln and generations had to do to get access to books and get this book which transformed their lives. And we have all of them right here, and all we need is the self-discipline to do it. So I've become a radical evangelist for the transformative power of deep reading. And we must read primary text. It is so important to go back and read the text yourself. Will, in your great introduction, you quoted Brandeis, that incredible passage from Brandeis. And I can do it as a party trick. So I'm gonna recite it. I want you to listen for the defense of free speech that's in there, which comes from Tacitus. Tacitus said that freedom to think as you will and speak as you think is crucial. Brandeis is a great classicist. He thinks that ancient Rome is the embodiment of freedom, and he's also a great Jeffersonian, and Jefferson quotes Tacitus too. So here's Brandeis on why free speech matters, as Will so well summarized, and let's just be inspired by these words. Brandeis says, "Those who won our revolution believed that the final end of the state was to make men free to develop their faculties, and that in its government, the deliberative forces should prevail over the arbitrary. They valued freedom both as an end and as a means. They believed liberty to be the secret of happiness and courage to be the secret of liberty." That's a quotation from Pericles' funeral oration. "They believed that freedom to think as you will and speak as you think," that's Tacitus, "were means indispensable to the discovery and spread of political truth, that without free speech and assembly, discussion would be futile, that with them, discussion affords ordinarily adequate protection against the dissemination of noxious doctrine, that the greatest threat to freedom is an inert people, that public discussion is a political duty, and that this should be a fundamental principle of the American government." It's just extraordinary. It just Brandeis distills all of that genius into this golden paragraph. And think about how that just expresses the classical wisdom that they believe that they're talking about the faculties of self-government. That word faculties comes from Pythagoras, that we have certain faculties, reason in the head, passion or emotion in the heart, desire in the stomach. And it's our job to use our powers of reason to moderate or modulate our unreasonable passions and emotions so we achieve that calm tranquility. And Brandeis, channeling all these great, this light, says that this is both a right and a duty. It's not just an opportunity we have, but it's a responsibility to live our lives in accordance and in alignment with divine reason, which is truth, which is the divine. And if we do that, then we'll realize that that freedom of speech is both a right and a responsibility, and it's necessary for the discovery and spread of political truth. Sylvia, in her wonderful leadership of the College of the Atlantic, shared with me this morning this great piece that Walter Lippmann wrote, describing how speech is not just a right, a chance to say what you think, but it's a duty to listen to points of view, because it's only in the process of clashing points of view that truth will emerge. And that's one of Brandeis's and Pericles's and Tacitus's central justifications for speech. The truth can only emerge, the discovery and spread of political truth, as Brandeis puts it, only emerges from this willingness to listen to different points of view. So we're seeing there's a beautiful symmetry to the Enlightenment faith in reason. It combines this focus on individual rights and autonomy and self-expression with the responsibility of collective participation in politics. And they have, I would say, hope. Faith is too strong, but hope that people can construct a republic guided by reason and reflection, not force or violence. That's what Hamilton says in Federalist One. The whole thing is an experiment. Can America be guided by reason or conviction and not force or violence? And no republic in history has ever pulled it off. Everywhere around them are tyrants and thugs and czars and murderous absolute rulers. This is an experiment, and they'll see whether or not it works. But it all comes down to individual citizens. And you're seeing how it's arduous to be a citizen in a republic. It takes work. You have to educate yourself. You can't just take the word of some faction or repeat some slogan or some extremist cant or dogma. You have to learn. You have to read the text so that you can think for yourself and speak as you think. So we'll see.
So he's brilliant. What do you say? I don't know.
No.
But Jeffrey, I want to go back to something, and that is to dialogue, to speaking. I don't think the founders ever thought that there would be a machine that would essentially posture as a human being, and that somehow we would be subject to the machinations of the machine AI, for example, to engage in that dialogue. So how do you feel about that?
There's so much to learn about AI, and I'm just beginning to even be able to articulate the questions. There's so many to ask, but I'm deeply concerned about a machine without reason. The machine has no reason. Artificial intelligence is intelligence without reason. And if the whole Enlightenment project is based on the faith that we must use our powers of reason to moderate our unreasonable passions, what to do in a world where that has no reason? Because if there's no reason, there's no wisdom.
But Jeffrey, communication, exchange, improving, I mean, the reason just doesn't come naturally. It comes from the interchange of minds. How does AI deal with that?
I don't know whether or how AI can do with it. And even the idea, my goodness, think for yourself and speak as you think, as opposed to having a machine synthesize and think for you without knowing the sources. We've got to go back to the primary text. Now, there is an AI platform now that gives footnotes, and that's urgently important. You must go back to the primary sources so that you can evaluate.
Jeffrey, footnotes is your answer?
Primary texts are my answer. I'm an evangelist.
I'm just a historian. I'm very impressed. But
we must read the primary text. That's what I, did. And it just changed. You've got to allow people to speak for themselves. However, you can also structure dialogue and debate to ensure that different points of view are heard. And it's so meaningful. I want to say a word about what an incredible privilege it is to work at the National Constitution Center, this extraordinary education center established by Congress during the bicentennial of the Constitution, the only institution in America chartered by Congress to increase awareness and understanding of the Constitution among the American people on a nonpartisan basis. I always recite the mission statement before our programs. Imagine Congress today establishing this nonpartisan center for constitutional light and learning. And the chairs are Justices Breyer and Justice Gorsuch. On all of our programs and projects, we bring together people of diverse points of view, liberals and conservatives, to explore agreement and disagreement about the Constitution. And the core of the platform is this amazing interactive Constitution. And you've got to check it out. It's constitutioncenter.org. It's gotten 80 million hits since we launched in 2015. It's among the most Googled constitutions in the world. You can click on any provision and see the leading liberal and conservative thinkers with 1,000 words about what they agree about and separate statements about what they disagree about. So Justice Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Katyal about the habeas corpus clause, agreement and disagreement, 80 clauses, all of these amazing scholars. But that's just the beginning. I'm like a Ginsu knife salesman here, but that's not all. In addition, there is this incredible, I do a weekly podcast where I call up a liberal and a conservative and explore historic and contemporary questions. As I said yesterday, we just recorded this great episode on constitutional politics throughout history and the degree to which the courts have reflected constitutional consensus from the founding to Reconstruction to Roosevelt to Reagan. And each week I learned something about the issue when I've heard both sides. I can't have an informed opinion about presidential immunity or the administrative state or anything else until I've heard the best arguments. And they're complicated, and there generally are good arguments on both sides. And I want you to be inspired to educate yourself and read the Supreme Court opinions. Read the majority opinions and the dissents. Read them yourself and make up your own mind, because there are very strong arguments on both sides. Then there is this great, there are primary sources so that kids can read them themselves and adults. And then this great Constitution 101 class, which, as I mentioned yesterday, we're about to launch with Khan Academy, and it's just going to go out to hundreds of thousands of kids. But it's for adult learners too. And please be moved to check out the videos. And maybe when we do our Zoom follow-up with these wonderful College of the Atlantic students and anyone who is moved to join, we can discuss a Supreme Court opinion, the majority opinion and the dissent. We can kind of model a class. What I'm saying is that it takes structure, and you have to reach out to get people of different points of view and not just content yourself with playing to your crowd and thinking you know all the right answers. And it takes work. You have to devote some time to it, and you have to separate your political from your constitutional views and learn about the history. But it's so inspiring. And you just see kids starting in middle school responding to it and digging in deep. And I'm always exhorting everyone, read the majority opinion on the dissent. And this middle school kid said, I'm Bill, I'm, 11. I'm not sure I can read the dissent, but he did. And, anyone can. People always rise to the challenge when they're inspired by enthusiasm and great teachers who we have at the Constitution Center and great material. So I'm, it's very, very possible to reconstruct that instinct and to save the next generation. That is exactly, and he's got to start reading the dissents as well in every respect.
So a final thought, it also takes courage to do this hard work now. So Sean, there are questions?
Yes, why don't we get started with questions, and I'll just ask the audience to speak right into the mic so the folks online can hear you.
So wonderful conversation. Do citizens choose tyrants because they're lazy? They say won't read the original test, they won't struggle with these things?
Well, yes, to a degree. They seek cheap answers. A demagogue is someone, I alone can fix it. You attack the elites, you promise simple solutions. It's simple. Trust me, give me the power. And that's the course throughout history. I mean, the founders read Polybius as the first big separation of powers guy, then Montesquieu channels it. And the standard Polybian account is you need separation of powers because all the pure forms of government degenerate into their antithesis. Monarchy becomes tyranny, and aristocracy becomes oligarchy, and the republic becomes the mob. And democracies or republics are among the least stable systems, because it's very easy to seek simple solutions in demagogues and tyrants, who then, and most come to power through elections and then subvert the institutions that gave them strength and say this is an emergency measure, and then you lose liberty. I mean, the founders don't, and the American Constitution does not have a high view of direct democracy. Now, Jefferson and Hamilton really disagree about this. Hamilton is absolutely concerned that democracies are unstable and that you need a really strong executive for life. Jefferson ultimately has faith that he trusts the people and believes that the majority should reign. That is a majority of white men on a local level. He has more faith in that. But that's why it's so important to study history, and that's why it's so important to learn.
Thank you, Dr. Rosen and Dr. Goldstein. That was a fantastic conversation. I just wanted to jump in on the kind of back and forth question and fear about AI, because I actually have the opposite hope. If your golden belief is in deep reading, mine is actually in deep neural nets and GPTs and the potential that they have for finally realizing a real democracy of an informed public. So GPTs, you said that the fear of AI not being based on reason. My understanding is that it has no passion, and that it's actually entirely based on reason, reason that we can read, that we can specifically look at the code. What is informing this? What is the actual information that it's making its judgments based on? And how does it change when we change those facts and update its understanding? There's a field of academic thought now called integral theory that is trying to reconcile the polarities of thought and bring together disciplines to understand reality from a place of humility and not knowing, rather than a hunch or a theory. And this is really only becoming possible because of the advances of AI, of neural nets, of GPTs that are able to say, what if we take all these thinkers and we put them into conversation with each other based on everything that they said? What do they mean by those words? Where are they actually agreeing, but using different perspectives, and start to do some of that thought work that could take us humans thousands and thousands of years to get to some level of understanding. So I just wanted to, you made several statements that I think reflect this about the fact that there is reason, there is truth somewhere. I believe we've gone past the moment of no facts, no truth, and then we're actually getting to a place where your type of thinking might actually be accessible in plain language for free on the internet instead of in the ivy towers of the political elite. So I'm very hopeful about that. It may not come till the fall of our republic, but if humanity goes on, then I hope that these technologies will actually allow us to realize a lot of the dreams that you are also inspired by. So
wonderful. Great question, and really inspiring and meaningful reminder that in addition to not having reason, the machines don't have passion and therefore might achieve a version of the thoughtful synthesis that can be misled by human emotions. And there are all sorts of wondrous uses of AI, including in the new Khan Academy course. Sal Khan is a real evangelist for AI, and we're going to have an interactive feature where the AI, which is carefully curated based on the sources it's drawing from, can ask questions to kids, and you have a personal tutor who's asking you constitutional questions and can encourage you to dig in deeper. It's just one of many transformative uses of AI in education. I'm not at all nothing close to a Luddite. As I said, I feel a sense of total humility before this technology and don't even know the questions to ask to frame them. However, in addition to the hope that a great synthesizer might be able to distill wisdom that minds will take human minds a lot longer, I do want to stress once again that for the ancients and the ancient wisdom, the pursuit of happiness is an individual duty to align the individual mind with reason. Because reason, which is truth, which is the divine harmony of the universe, is something that the individual has to aspire to, and in that sense, to try to be perfect. And Pythagoras tells his disciples to first be good and then live like gods. And the way to live like a god is through rigorous self-mastery of eating and drinking and reading and reason. And you'll never achieve it. Only the divine can achieve perfection, but it's the effort itself, it's the pursuit, it's the trying and failing, it's the daily, hourly struggles to keep your temper and keep your focus and not be distracted by perseverating and unproductive thoughts so that you can tune in and try to be more perfect. And that's the crucial language, it's more perfect. And no machine can become more perfect for us. It can help us in our task and can help us inspire us to improve ourselves and cultivate our own faculties. But ultimately, it's an individual responsibility.
Thank you so much for this conversation. It was really inspirational. I'm the director of the Abbey Museum here in town. And I'd like to make a comment to be additive to the conversation about linking back to the ancients and to our more perfect union. The thing that was missing for me in the conversation, not to be critical, but to say that, you know, part of learning and going back to primary sources, I really value what you brought up about that we really need to understand the roots of our democracy, the thinking behind it and the values that are behind it. What was missing in this conversation for me was Ben Franklin and Madison were looking not only to Europe, but to the one existing long-standing democracy that was existing in the United States, which was the Iroquois Confederacy. And they name it in that they had federalism, separation of powers, and a representative democracy. And one of the few things that particularly Franklin did not adopt from the Iroquois Confederacy was the power of women in the system. And I think we're at a really big crossroads right now in our democracy. I think you'll see that Native people really, really care about our democracy. We are tied into the roots of it. I just wanted to add that in your thinking and learning about going back to primary sources. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so glad that you introduced the crucial importance of Native American constitutionalism, which was indeed an influence on Franklin, an example of his growth. Remember, he started off, he had an enslaved person in his household, and he overcame that experience and became a great abolitionist as well as a defender of Native American rights. And he learned from them in the construction of America. In this, he was not supported by Jefferson or Jefferson's successors, in particular Jackson, whose brutal policy of Native American removal was both central to their vision of a West populated by free white men and resulted in an indefensible assault on Native American rights. And it's really striking to see the battle over Native American rights where the Federalists and John Marshall are defending the treaties and national power, and Jackson and his successors are brutally betraying it. It's encouraging today on the court to see the Supreme Court to see a revival of Native American rights. As it happens, Justice Gorsuch, our co-chair, is the most ardent defender of Native American rights on the U.S. Supreme Court today because of his originalist and textualist principles. And just to confirm your point about the degree to which Native American rights are reflected in the text of the Constitution, Justice Gorsuch, in the Oklahoma case and others, is resurrecting that text to try to right some of the subversion of those rights throughout history. Thank you very much for that point.
Thank you, Judith. Thank you, Jeffrey. That was riveting.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's conversation between legal scholar Jeffrey Rosen and political scientist Judith Goldstein was recorded live at the College of the Atlantic's 2024 Summer Institute. This has been the final episode of a four-part series from the College of the Atlantic. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can also find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, which is produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.